Welcome to The Womb Radio. I'm Paul Kavicki, your host, better known as Pounce, the moderator of the live audio forum. Our intro music was from the band Earwig, and today we're talking with Lizard McGee from the band Earwig and Lizard Family Music. Welcome to Womb Radio.
Hello, thanks for having me.
We have a lot that we could possibly talk to you about because I really want to make sure anybody listening to this kind of gets up on the history, because I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who are walking in your footsteps or trying to. As long as I've known you, you've been in some sort of... When I was first getting interested in music, you had already had your first band and were playing proficiently, and your laser-like focus on doing music for the rest of your life is truly turned out.
Yeah. I've been at it for a while. As they say, I've been around the block a few times, for better or for worse. So I've been through a lot of situations and dealt with a lot of things.
Now, how long has your band Earwig been in existence with one lineup or another?
Honestly, Earwig's been, our first 7-inch came out in 1992.
Okay,
and the whole time it's been self-released on our own record label. There's been a couple of shots where we could have done other things or were supposed to do other things with bigger labels or different labels, but ultimately everything has been self-produced, self-recorded, produced, released on our own, and we totally do all the booking, promotion, etc.
And we'll have more about that to talk about, but additionally, there's Lizard Family Music, and although right now you are primarily dealing with Earwig, in the past there have been other a number of other independent bands, mostly locally based, that you've been a label for.
Yeah, Earwig is currently the flagship band for Lizard Family Music, or LFM Records. It's a label that I started pretty much to self-release Earwig and to focus on a small scene that was happening in Columbus, which was basically a lot of bands I became involved with ended up recording and putting out records and doing promotions and tours, like any scene develops. And we were all kind of mutual admiration society of each other, fans of each other. But as things do, a lot of those bands fell by the wayside or no longer existed, but Earwig still exists. So right now I'm just kind of focusing. Earwig's the only active band on LFM right now.
Are you on CD Baby as well?
Oh yeah, CD okay. Baby. I'm a big fan of Derek and what he does at CD Baby. We've been on there for a few years, and I'm mainly on CD Baby right now to be hooked up through their digital distribution stuff. It's a good website and to have people be able to see it, but the majority of CDs I sell through our website, and we make more money that way. But the digital stuff, I think CD Baby's great, and so we're on iTunes and all the digital outlets through CD Baby.
So while we're still in the fairly introductory part of this, it's merits pointing out that anybody listening can go to iTunes, look up Earwig. Mm-hmm. They can go to CD Baby, look up Earwig. You can go to MySpace Music, look up Earwig. There's a variety of places. Yeah. They can find you, see the pictures, see the audio previews of the CDs, and best of all, buy it too.
Right. Our website is lizardfamily.com. www.lizardfamily.com, and the MySpace is MySpace/Earwig, or if you just search for Earwig, I think we come up pretty early on Google, like the third hit or something like that.
Yeah, that way if you're listening to the Earwig interview, then go ahead and look for the website, and you can.
And we're on iTunes and all the and eMusic, any of the digital outlets, you can find our stuff.
So one of the things we did a little bit of a pre-interview, and one of the things you talked about was for you, and this is all you do, is
right.
Music. So that was one of the first points to get across. This is your gig, is music.
Yeah, well, like so many musicians, I'm also an audio professional, and I'm doing the quotation marks around that because it's not so much professional as I don't get paid as much as I would like to. But I run live sound, I record bands, and I do a lot of that work. And I used to do a lot of that work for my band just out of the nature of...
Necessity.
And then at some point along the line, I really decided I think I would get a better result if I tried to separate myself and focus more my energies on being the artist and find other people to do recordings, production, etc. And that's kind of where we are now. And I think I've been better off.
I want to say I like your live recordings, but you guys are very much a live band.
Right, you've seen us live. We try to tour as much as possible. Everybody has, except for me. I'm pretty much full time doing the band, doing placements for songs, trying to find what income from the band. The other two guys, it's just a three-piece, guitar, bass, and drums, and I sing and play guitar. The other two guys, Matt and Justin, the bass player and drummer, they have day jobs. Justin just graduated from OSU. He has a degree, a literature degree. And so they have full-time, part-time jobs, and they tour with me to promote the band, to promote the record. And then while we're not touring, I work on promotions and song placement, distribution, all that jazz.
With respect to both time and money, can you tell me the breakdown between the amount of shows you might typically do in a single year, how many CDs you have out, and how the money relates? Whether you make more money at shows, at merchandise, with digital distribution, with physical CDs, how do you make it financially viable?
For us, it really goes in cycles, and I find myself, for instance, this year, 2007, we've done a lot of touring. We toured in 2005 off of a DVD that we put out called The Year of the Drag, which was kind of a mishmash collection of hodgepodge, I guess, of live stuff and new tracks, and we tried to make a DVD and see how that would sell and did a tour from it. Didn't sell very well at all, although we toured a lot. Then for 2006, we basically recorded and mixed and finished up an album and did all the planning for releasing it in 2007 and touring and promoting it. So this year's been really active, whereas 2006 was the year that we kind of didn't tour a lot because we were at home and I was spending money on the recording and production of the record. So 2007, we put out the record, toured, and I've been promoting it, securing distribution, etc. And now we just did basic tracks for the next record, and so the cycle's starting over again, where I think pretty much this winter we're going to be dormant and then put out a record in the spring and tour a lot next summer and fall. But so this year, so it averages out, this year we played more shows than 2006 by a long shot.
And this, does it also cyclically affect you, where in my side of the live audio business, this is a slower time, this summer, and the other times are the hotter times to be touring. So this is the perfect time to be a studio rat.
Right. I try to set it up with the last album and with this album where I am doing the bulk of the mixing, recording in the winter. Because for us, two things, we play... A lot of the touring we do where we can make money is for a college audience and school, so it might make more sense to tour in the winter when school is in session. But really, if we can catch the spring and then tour through the summer, that's when it's the best time for us. So we just did that this past year. We toured over the summer and then the fall, and now it's December. So we're closing that part up, and we're concentrating on doing the recording.
Instead of going right for gossip, let me ask you something. In the application of this process over the past number of years, releases, tours, which kinds of contacts have you made that you said, this is somebody I need to keep working with? What kind of relationships have you developed? And one of the things that comes to mind is you talked a little about CD Baby, and we talked previously a little bit about Taxi and,
right.
and some of the kinds of people that you said, these are good guys that are, you know, honestly working for the good of the artist. What relationships have helped you?
Well, in the, if you want to call it the music business, you know, so many positions or people that you meet come and go. Like if I've met A&R guys or music supervisors for TV shows that have placed our songs, the next year they might not have that job anymore. But generally, whenever there are a lot of good people you meet, like producers, engineers, music supervisors, A&R guys, whatever, people that work at radio. And I try to maintain those relationships somewhat, and in hopes that, you know, well, just, you know, out of wanting to continue the relationship, but, you know, try to keep track of the good guys to see where they land and where I can continue that relationship in the future. But the question was...
Well, yeah, instead of focusing too much on the bad guys yet,
right.
who are the good guys who in some way... made you left with the feeling that they were helping you succeed, or even tangibly, you know, they brought enough money somehow to the projects, or connected you to Well, to opportunities you wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
I've made a lot of good connections through being involved with Taxi, which, you know, I hear a lot of feedback from other people. It could sometimes go either way depending on someone's personal experience with Taxi. But
And also point out, if people have, you know, slightly older copies of, was it EQ or Mix or whatever, there's the full page right. Spread for Taxi.
I submitted a lot of stuff when I lived in California and was really trying to build up my music industry connections. I submitted a lot of stuff to Taxi, had a lot of stuff forwarded, was lucky enough to do a couple of bigger deals and met Michael Laskow, who's the president of Taxi, and did a full page ad for them where they used a picture of me to promote Taxi. And that was really good because in the following few years since then, I pretty much concentrate on, I'm anal about keeping contacts and keeping in touch with them. So anybody that, even if I was made a connection through Taxi, but it didn't turn into a deal where I made any money, I tried to stay on top of it and forward to more music in the future and try to just on my own follow through on the connection. So I would say since Taxi is a good service, there's a lot of people in and out of that service. You know, that's how I met Kenny, was through something that we did through Taxi where I ended up recording a session with him.
Okay, so we then for the full disclosure, we have to mention that the track that we're using on the opening and closing of this interview was mixed by our own Kenny Gioia,
yep.
Out in Wrong Island.
With very minimal equipment, I might add.
And this was also, should be pointed out, this was also mixed to tape. This was all done with no computer Pro Tools stuff at all.
To the best of my recollection, that's what I'm recalling. Just a Mackie mixer, you know, 8-bus mixer and a 2-inch tape machine and some distressors.
But, you know, Kenny was actually cutting tape.
Yeah, there on a couple of those songs, there might have been, I don't know if it's the track we used or not, but they're probably an edited performance somewhat where he actually cut the 2-inch tape and put it together.
It's different than the Kenny we know now.
And even then, I could recognize the brilliance in his procedure.
You know, you've met our buddy Charles Dye.
And I also had the pleasure of meeting Charles Dye. I'm a live audio engineer, and I work in Athens, Ohio. And he attended OU, Ohio University in Athens, and returned last year just by chance to a club where I was the house sound guy, just a kind of restaurant club, and was mixing for a band that he went to college with. And when he introduced himself to me and kind of like at some point hit on his resume high points, I really didn't believe him. I was like, oh, okay, I don't know what you're doing here, you know. Then just through the night, spoke to him a little bit, and he gave me his DVD, which later on I found very useful and wished I had watched it ahead of time so I could ask him a lot more questions.
Mix it like a record.
Mix it like a record. There's a plug. So yeah, Charles was a really great guy to work with just the one night that I met him, but he seemed like a really nice guy.
And I never stopped being amused at pointing out that technically you played my 17th birthday party in my parents' basement. So
we must bring that up, it is true.
Yes. So somehow you have some association with at least three of the moderators.
Right. Oddly enough, I'm headed for whoever the other six of them. I'm gonna hit them here before I die.
I see. For the people that are uninitiated, in our pre-interview, you explained a little bit more about the Taxi process and at least one or two of the gigs that resulted from it for Earwig. Can you let folks know what it's kind of like?
Sure. With Taxi, it's a service. They produce listings. People in the music industry list their needs for songs, and that would be people ranging from A&R men to someone who's a music supervisor for a TV show or a product that they need a song for. They have listings for Taxi. If you belong to the service, you submit music. Taxi screens it. If they feel that you are good enough or meet the muster for the listing, they forward you to the person who did it. And then if they like it, they contact you. So there's a really small percentage of stuff that actually gets forwarded and even a smaller percentage that is contacted or ends up in a deal. I belonged to that service for several years. And then a few things that happened out of there. One of them was Earwig submitted music to Taxi and we ended up getting a production deal with a guy, and that's how I ended up working with Kenny, was the engineer on some stuff that we recorded in Long Island. It was supposed to be shopped for a record deal, and I don't know, whatever. That kind of petered out. That was like a weird experience, but it was good getting to go out. Also got to work with some other engineers out there. And then another thing, you know, it ranges from that to where we did a deal with, there was an advertiser, a national product who, there's an advertising firm, Leo Burnett in Chicago, that was putting together a promotional CD for a company, and they needed bands, and they hired us to just fly us to Chicago and record us at a nice studio with A-list producers to make a track for a CD, and they paid us well, and then that was, you know, given away free as a promotional CD for a national company.
In fact, what one of the things you just said made me kind of want to piggyback with a question here.
Okay.
When we did our pre-interview, you were talking about the times that you were flirting with label interests or flirting with deals that could have truly brought either greater exposure or real money to you. Now, it's also true there's some bands that by the nature of what they do, they're not, you know, they're always going to be like they're less likely to get that big label deal. But you guys have really flirted with it a few times, and there's something to be said for what kind of a reasonable expectations and approach you have once you've realized that had that night before Christmas feeling a few times
in a
row.
Yeah, that's happened when you, we've been approached for different deals, you know, people flown into town to see us, like A&R men or publishing people, and they, the first few times that happens, you really think that something's going to happen out of it. I've had just been at home and been called by the, you know, president of A&R at Columbia Records, and he's telling me how he loves something and wants to sign the band. Just things like that have happened, and I don't know why, but for Earwig, it's never really come to fruition of like having it actually happen. And I guess if anything, that strengthened our resolve of going through that process a few times for me to be really adamant about doing things myself and trying to push it as far as I can, and realizing that I'm not going to rely on just some long shot, but try to build things, try to find ways to make money that aren't just the big money shot dream, but ways of placing songs, different ways to sell and distribute CDs. Now there's so many different things that are coming up with ways, places to place music and places to sell CDs and then touring and all the other ways to make money and keep going as a band and not just hang our hat on we're going to get a record deal.
You, in stark contrast to many of the musicians I encounter, you're unusually adamant about keeping names and following up and, well, generally doing business right. And I've always thought that that was one of the bigger downfalls of many musicians in general, which is to say that they're in the music business and they're better at the music part than they are at the business part. It seems like your dedication to that is one of the only reasons that you're able to resolve, come up with a resolve to succeed. Can you tell us, though, about whether it's the time commitment or the monetary commitment or what it takes to do that? Because that's, I think that's an unusually, it's an unusually difficult effort.
Yeah, I would just say ahead of time that really Earwig has only had moderate success, really. Mm-hmm. But we've had enough success where I can survive on it and also keep the other band members paid enough to stay involved. And we've all kind of matured along with it to where we don't have any interband friction where we're going to blow up and quit. So that's one thing, is just having the temperament for longevity, just to stay at it as a band and keep going in spite of the ups and downs. And early on, that's what I'm saying. I was fortunate enough, the very first stuff that we did, I sent out to record labels and had people call me back and send, you know, in the 90s, like right back to my letters, which I guess was kind of not a normal thing. So I was encouraged in it. And at first I thought maybe things would just happen along. So my trajectory was doing something, things I recorded on my own. I went to recording school and then started the band, made some recordings, sent them out, got some interest. And I thought, okay, here we go. Something will happen. But then from that initial interest, nothing happened. And as I learned more about the DIY aspect of the business, doing it myself, I started my own record label, started handling publishing, started doing promotions, booking my own tours, and doing this for other bands that were on the record label. Along the way, I've gained experience doing that and found out things to do to keep myself going.
Precisely to that point, at least in one instance, you signed up with an expensive agency that was set to promote Earwig for you. How would you contrast the cost, the results, and their approach with your own?
Okay. Well, recently this year, we've had luck. Our recent album, Earwig album called Center of the Earth, there was a track on it called Used Kids, which is an ode to an independent record store here in town in Columbus, Ohio called Used Kids Records.
I think it's easier to like that album more if you know where Old Man's Cave is and Used Kids is.
So there are a lot of Midwestern references on that record anyway. We put that record out, had the good luck to have that song really take off locally on the radio here in town. Used Kids was a moderate or to actually pretty big success locally on a big commercial radio station here in town. And that led to a distribution deal with Meyer Stores that I got on my own. And then through that distribution deal, made some money, and I decided to continue with a tour and hired on a national promotion company of note to do college radio promotion and a new media internet promotion, which my thinking at the time was, it's time to take a chance. Here's some money rather than just keep it in the bank or whatever, or spend it on recording. Let's go ahead and spend it to try to parlay it into some bigger exposure for the band. So we spent it. It was a good chunk of change. And honestly, now looking back on it, I mean, I had to take the step at the time to know whether it would be worth it or not. But it was largely, we didn't really make back what I spent, but it was a good experience. And it exposed us a lot, but it doesn't translate into to CD sales or iTunes sales. Actually, we made more money off CD sales and iTunes just having the local exposure. When we were really being played a lot on the radio locally, made a ton more than we did by spending a lot of money to try to thin that out over a national audience. But it was a good experience because it opened a lot of, I'd say music editors at magazines or people with websites that do music promotion that hadn't heard of the band. And hopefully that opened up some doors that we can take advantage of for the promotion of the next record. But I actually, to get back to your question, I've done more on my own and had more success just handling my own promotions than I did when I paid a company a lot of money to do it for me. And I, looking back on it, I was like, well, if I could have just paid myself to really spend, 24 hours a day, which I pretty much do anyway.
And if I remember the number you tossed out before, it was, it was thousands of dollars.
Like $5,000 to $6,000, yeah, okay, for 3 months.
Okay. I thought I remembered it even higher than that, but still.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, on the grand scale of things, I'm sure major labels throw a lot of money out. But for me, for an indie label, that was quite a bit of money for us. And I really talked it over. I handle all the business decisions running the record label and the business of the band with the other two guys because they want to, like any musician, they're like, they don't want to have anything to do with the business. But I don't have that luxury because if it's going to happen, I'm going to have to make it happen. And that's pretty much the attitude that I've taken. And that's where I've had any success is I realize if I want my band to get noticed, it has never just happened. I have to make it happen.
Have you found this to be true? I do find in all the independently motivated bands that I run into, there is the one guy that takes care of the business. It's never a fully democratic thing that everybody's to. It's just one guy has to just step up to the plate.
Yeah, typically that's how it happens. Or there will be a band and where they might have a manager in place that does that. But pretty much we're self-managed. I'm the manager of the band and I run the record label and I'm the publisher. I wear all those hats. But in other bands that I've studied that have had some success, there's usually somebody that's taking up the flag of the band and carrying it forward to do the business.
Have you found a formula for getting yourself either into the rotation or into those stores that you think you can reapply for future releases?
Well,
or do you have to write a song about local people every for each
that
market?
That was part of the catch locally. I think probably, and I don't really know how much people can take from this, but I'll just try to be honest, is like the biggest successes we've had is where I've put my business hat on and decided, here's something I want. How do I get that? And really laid out for myself, that's the result I want, and what do I need to do to get that result? So to take those two examples, number one, getting on a big commercial station locally, CD101 in Columbus, having a song in the top five there for several months, and then B, getting our CD distributed through Meyer Stores, which is a national chain. They put us in 7 million circulars, over five states, 178 stores. We're in the end cap featured there. Both those things, I decided that I wanted, and I kind of psyched myself up that I'm going to get it, and I put myself in charge of how to do it. So for CD101, I really just looked at our CD and what could appeal to that radio station to get us on there and developed a story, developed a pitch, went into the station, waited to get a meeting with the program director unannounced. just asked him if I could talk, just showed up. And then I went in his office. I said, I want you to play our, I think you guys should play our song. It'd be, we're a local band. The community would really get behind us. And he said, well, just tell me why. I had already prepared a 2-minute pitch of, here's the song. Here's why. It'd be good for you. It'd be good for us. And I had psyched myself up that the only answer to this pitch I'm giving could be yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I presented it to him exactly like that. And it kind of made sense to him. And then actually he put it on the air and that happened. And for whatever series of events caused it to happen, maybe it was somehow just me being determined about it. And the same thing with Meyer. I saw in USA Today that Meyer was opening up a distribution of local artists. And I got the guy's name on the, I just Googled on the internet, found him, found a phone number, and I called the guy and found out how to submit music to him. It was early on in the program. And so that day I sat down and I made a list of the 10 reasons that he wanted to pick us. I knew what they wanted from the program. They wanted like music that didn't need a explicit lyrics warning sticker. For instance, they needed something that was already packaged and they could sell that appealed to this demo, whatever.
Yeah,
I knew all the things they wanted.
And so for all of those guys, things like UPC codes are, you
right.
know, you absolutely have to have that. Right. We're not even talking about.
Exactly. So we already had a professionally produced CD with a UPC code that I was selling just locally. So I figured out the top 10 things he wanted, like what would be the home run for him to get on his desk. And so I took those, I came, formulated 10 ideas, and then I answered them all with the end result being Earwig is that band for each of these 10 questions. And I put that down on a piece of paper. And with that, I sent him minimal press stuff and the CD. And he actually, then he called me the next week when he got it. And he somehow, it just came through. He received it in the same manner that I had sent it. Like when he read it, it was just like how I wanted to present it to him, that it's a no-brainer. Here are the 10 things you want. Here's why that's me. And he just accepted it like that and thought it was a great idea.
That's a lot smarter business sense than some of the bands. They just can't put on the business hat. And that
well, it's really hard. The thing that I find hard is promoting myself. I mean, like right now, I don't want to talk about myself. I want, for instance, when the other guy, so I'm in a band with two other guys. I also run the record label. I need pictures of the band for the website. So me, the label head, says, hey, band, I need pictures. And the guys in the band, well, oh, I don't want to take my picture. I hate having my picture taken. I feel like that too, because I don't want to have my picture taken. But I'm also the guy saying, hey, I need the pictures. So it's really kind of hard to find that. And promoting yourself, I feel like a dork talking about myself or pitching myself to someone, telling them why I'm great. But you really have to kind of somewhere find a way. If you're going to promote yourself and be successful at it, you have to find the ability to separate yourself from yourself as an artist and get in touch with your business side and find the good aspects of it and be able to communicate that to somebody.
Now one thing you're pointing out, though, in your two successful marketing approaches,
right.
Both of them were particular for the recipient. I hear time and again, no matter how many times people do this, just bulk mailing a whole bunch of stuff is extremely expensive and has a low yield.
Right. My bulk comes from like all day long. I'm like, well, not all day, every day, but in the promotion of my band or trying to find successes, my radar is on for, you know, a blog that I might want to get a write-up in, or a magazine I want to get a write-up in, or a distribution deal I want, or a radio station I want. So I keep, you know, the Meyer deal and the CD101 were just two ideas out of maybe like 15 ideas I was thinking of that month. And I focused on a bunch of them. The others, you know, didn't pan out, but these two did. And all of them, I generated a bunch of ideas, things that I wanted to do, and probably made specific approaches for all those. And I can't remember the ones that weren't successes, but I had just as many things that I sent out specifically for targeted people. I don't do a lot of mass sending out. I try to, like, if I'm doing press and promotions for the record or tour promotions, I am very specific. Like, here's the Tribune in Detroit that writes about bands that play at this club. I find that information out. I want them to do a feature on us because we're going to play at this club. So I find the guy who writes the features. I start by developing, you know, some kind of email correspondence with him, get him interested. And if I can, out of five people that I'm trying to get a correspondence with, whoever takes the bite first, then I try to really build a relationship, send them everything they need, make sure that they write a feature about it, and try to really specifically have a goal for who I'm talking to.
How much can you do on the internet? And how much do people even still want actual photos and CDs, or how much is sending them links to photos and bios and MP3s? How much is that not only enough, but even preferred for some people?
When sending out materials or contacting people, if it's about shows or press or magazines, whatever, radio, definitely I find now I'm doing a lot more of sending links online. I have a folder that I keep. It's kind of like my virtual press kit of all the, you know, I have the photos and everything online, but I send links to them and with excerpts from the bio. So I have a small, concise email that I can send that hits on all those and has links to all the other things if they want to pursue it more.
A related question, how much of your song material, even if it's not seen by the public, how much do you have, like a folder where you've got a complete sets of all the real songs that internet radio and other people like
exactly.
that can
link to? I have MP3s of everything online. Mm-hmm. And actually for the older albums that are now out of print, I readily send that link to people. Like if people email me and they're like, oh, we love Perfect Past Tense, which is this stuff that's you've heard today, the stuff that Kenny recorded, how can I get that? I'm like, well, I don't sell that anymore. It's available on iTunes, or you can have these lower versions. You know, I pretty much freely send those out and then people appreciate that, and it's not really cutting. It only, typically what I find is then they'll get that and listen to it and then buy the new record, which I still sell physical copies of, or they'll recommend it. It'll mean more sales for the other stuff, with the newer stuff on iTunes. But I send out, the thing is, I would think so I have this virtual press kit that I send out. I do send out physical press kits whenever I can make a personal connection. I don't blanket send anything, but if I, you know, the guy at the New York Times music writer, you know, if I'm getting in touch with him and he's piqued his interest, I'll send him something personal in the mail if he knows it's coming and I can follow up with it online. But generally, I send everything out through emails, and I think that that's good because it's cheaper, and so I can do a lot more. I can do more of a mass. I can try to contact a bunch of people and have my first contact be this virtual press kit. And then the people that I get a bite out of, I can follow up with them and then send them something real in the mail. And that's generally how I operate it.
Got a similar question. Now I'm turning my head over to live shows.
Okay.
But with respect to live shows, to any of the paperwork, including stage plots, input lists, technical riders, or actually more important, performance contracts and personal riders.
I was wondering which one you were going to ask about.
The first, really, I don't need to know your input list now, unless I'm going to mix for you. But for instance, did you ever get to a point where you said, did you grab a generic form online? Did you come up with something on your own? Did you say, all right, I'm going to get a lawyer once to review a contract because you wanted the security of having somebody look at
it? Most of that stuff I've just grabbed. I've Googled and mm-hmm. then found things online and grabbed it and adapted to suit my needs, like a typical, if it's a writer or an input list or a contract, which I do think those things are very important, but we haven't until recently dealt with those. Pretty much the school of indie music we come from is like booking shows with other bands, and a lot of those shows, it's very, very informal, and you know, some band from Philadelphia might call me and they found us on MySpace and want to do a show and we'll trade with them. I don't do a contract. I just book a show and then put them on the bill, and that's the kind of follow-up I get from them. They book a show and hopefully I've done my research and there are going to be people there and I can do some promotion in addition and we show up. But now, since we've...
And I hope to not embarrass you by saying you,
sure.
as you describe your band and the shows and that, you say it's modest success. You know, you're an indie band. You're making a living at it. You're doing the music you love,
right.
Which is, by a lot of people's definition, success.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, you're not doing stadium shows. You're doing shows with a very indie vibe and a very particular kind of scene attached to it.
Oh, yeah. And that's our bread and butter. To say, and I make enough money to keep myself going and keep doing more, and we're starting, especially with the success we've had this year, to enter into like the next realm of that, which means with the radio success we had this year, we played some of the bigger venues in town, like the LC. We did a spring show that was sponsored by the radio station.
About a 3,200 seater.
Yeah, it was about 2,000 people for that show, nice. And it was like a radio station promoted show, and that led to, we also headlined ComFest, nice. Which is a live, I guess, I've heard it called the nation's largest free outdoor live music event.
It's semi-legendary and extremely well-attended.
Right, so that was probably about 4,500 people we played to on the Friday night there. But it's a free outdoor event, but that was a lot of exposure for us. And we didn't get paid, but it led to, kept the single going on the radio. And recently we've been doing, not so many yet, but this year coming up, we'll be doing shows at House of Blues. I'm kind of tapping into, there's a touring artist that we met last year that might have us open for them at House of Blues. So as we go into those type of venues, rather than just connecting with a band and playing at the local club, I'm getting more into contracts and input lists and things like that, which honestly I haven't used so much in the past just because it's not really the way things happen on the level of touring, which is like shows anywhere from, 30, 50 to 250 people. But when I'm doing something for where we're going to make more money at clubs, hopefully the stuff that we'll be doing more from now on, I definitely am using all those. And what I've done is found like templates for a stage plot or templates for a contract live thing. And I just adapt them.
I wonder if there's a forum somewhere that would have templates like that.
Ah, that would be some, yes, there might be a forum that would have those. Where would that be?
The one thing I'm thinking is that if you're not a touring band, especially if you're just a fan of music, they so grossly underestimate the actual costs of driving a band, housing a band, feeding a band, promoting an out-of-town show, and everything that's intertwined into this whole process. At least you guys with three people, you can maybe limit yourselves to one vehicle.
That's very true. And we really exist on the side of that line, which is we keep everything to an absolute minimum. When we tour, me being the band mother or the band father, however, I own a van. And I book all the shows. I handle all of our booking. And basically what we do is it's a minivan. I have a Void Villager.
That's not very rock and roll.
No, it's not.
I might have to edit this out.
Okay. The band van, take the back seat out. We're a trio. So all of our gear, all of our merchandise fits into the back of the van. And the three of us ride in it. And we only stay in hotels maybe 20% of the time. The rest of the time we're finding relatives or other bands calling in favors. Or possibly like driving overnight in a bad situation. The recent tour we were on, we only had one overnight drive with no place to stay. And we only stayed in a hotel two nights. The rest of the nights we met people or knew ahead of time that we had a contact with the band. We could stay the night or there were relatives or friends. So just try to work all that out ahead of time.
What about venue? Now this is precisely what makes me ask with your contacts or contracts with the venues. Do you ever put in things like food provisions, things like that?
For us, rarely, because we're just now starting to break into that level of things. Like these shows, we did the radio shows and a few other shows we've done nationally where they provide food and dressing rooms. Typically, there's no dressing room at the clubs we've been playing because they're 300 to 500, audience member venue. But I love it when they have food. And we tend to round up all that food and take it with us so it lasts a couple days.
Oh, I understand, and I'm semi-spoiled by having the opportunity to work on larger shows, but then that makes me think when, I guess that was part of the reason I asked about contracts, is not so much that there was so much money involved, but if you were out of state and everything fell south for a small band and a small label, losing that much money and getting totally screwed could really put the hurt on something. And in fact, if that happened enough times, I'm not saying through your own fault, just it could be, scummy club owners or whatever, or just, miscommunication. If you're always on the edge, it always makes me worry more that, maybe they can last one show that something goes really bad, but the second show something goes really bad, then it throws everybody off, and then the third time it's really sketchy.
Yeah, that's very important, and we've been fortunate. I mean, typically kind of the way that I've pieced tours together is we have pockets of people that are really interested in us, but unfortunately they're spread out. Like in Las Cruces, New Mexico, there's a group of guys that are from a military base that are just crazy Earwig fans, and we go there and make a ton of money. And I can set up a show there and know we're going to make several hundred dollars. There was a guy in Atlanta who is a successful computer programmer who's a big Earwig fan and just wanted to have us play a private party that he has every year. And, he agreed to pay us like $1,500.
I got a question. I saw you in the recent past play at the halftime for the Ohio Roller Girls, and that certainly by my estimation, and I think by all descriptions, was a very, very hip gig to take. it's just enough time has passed since you did that. So Ohio Roller Girls is a all-female roller derby that is just sex on wheels. It's just, it is, I think it's the best.
It's a great
thing.
Organization. It's all the hip people, all the sexy, crazy alternative people.
I could not like it more. And having said that, that seems also very much to be your target audience. Has enough time passed? Can you ever look at sales of CDs or online or whatever and say, hey, this little bump correlates with that last show we did?
Oh, yeah. Because I keep track. I have a page for our website where I can see the hits, and then I can look at what we sold for certain months. And that's what I was saying. Our biggest success this year has been having the song played on the local radio station a ton. It really, really spiked like May, June, July was our biggest hump. And the Roller Girls thing came after that. And those people, that alternative set of people, that's our key target audience. And they really tied in, and that kind of spread out that hump a little bit. And I can see we got a lot of attention as far as web hits and some sales and some stuff due to that. But an interesting thing to talk about, live sound. That was a really interesting gig, the Roller Girls gig. Because
you're beating me to my next question, but go ahead.
Well,
I'm just thinking the question, so go ahead and answer it.
So that's a great gig. It's Roller Girls. It's an organization, totally hip. They want us to come play the halftime. We'll be the rock band during the rock and roll roller derby, you know. And there's tons of people. They bring all the people. We showed up. So they contracted us to play or whatever. They didn't mention sound at all. And of course, me, I would just assume, hey, they've got that under control.
I love you, Lizard, but I will say that, I would never book a gig without asking.
Yeah, it was a big... And I got shit from the guys in the band for this, although I felt really defensive about it at the time.
Oh, come on, cut to the chase. You got there. There's no PA.
No PA, yeah,
nothing,
exactly.
Not a mic, not a
nothing,
cable, nothing.
Exactly. And I couldn't believe it. I was totally caught off guard, because that's not where my brain, you know, of all the hats I wear, I wasn't thinking of the guy who's forwarding our stage plot. You know, that I totally dropped the ball. So
the folks you were playing for, they have different halftime acts for every one of their bouts, and they're pretty big. So this is not their first.
Yeah. So they ask us to play. I was thinking automatically they would have PA, and they were thinking, oh, if you're in a band, you're going to bring the PA. Because that's what they dealt with before. We show up, it's a big building at the fairgrounds, very, very large building with a stage, kind of like a high school auditorium, something. Nobody's going to hear us without a mic.
Not even close, yeah.
So we showed up, and everything's going to start in about an hour and a half, and there's no PA. And the guys in the band wanted to go home, and they're like, screw it, you know, nothing's going to happen, and they were giving me shit. And I'm constantly trying to, like, well, how do I make the best out of this situation? I'm not going to give up. What can I do? So we tried to make some calls to have people. They told me there was no PA there, and they had no use of any PA anywhere. And so I started trying to round up a PA, even just like a mic and a stand and a guitar amp to plug it into, just to hear the vocal.
And the four, like... you know, horn, old, you know, 50-year-old Altec Lansing horns that they have up there for public address announcements were so not what you would use.
Right. Well, they didn't have that. They had all these little bitty speakers, just like paper cones hanging from the ceiling for announcements all over this room, which would be really bizarre if I was playing on a stage in the corner and my vocals were coming out of the ceiling equally.
It was
a nightmare waiting to happen. So. We were making arrangements to have a friend of ours who was sick, broken arm, something, get out of bed, round up his gear, bring it. We were going to pay him something. But at the and the people there at the
Lausche building
at the fairgrounds, who had said that they had no equipment available. Eventually we did grind them down. They felt like, well, they said, yeah, there's some PA over from this other building that we can get. So we had the people from Roller Girls intervene with them and really put the pressure on them. They brought it just exactly, you know, 10 minutes before we could play. They set it up. So there's a microphone with the...
two EVs,
powered speakers.
Yeah.
But it was totally loud enough, so we played. And it actually really, I think, added to the show, because we were all, the two guys in the band had already given up on it and like didn't have any investment in it. They're like, screw it, nothing's going to happen. Then at the last minute, we got this PA, we're like, set up and let's just go. So there was some tension. And it was beautiful. I mean, we got a really good reaction from the crowd, and it was adequate. You know, you could hear the vocals over the music, which is kind of loud. I have a Fender Twin amp, and the bass player has his rig, and the drums were just live with no PA.
So, sometimes I wonder if many bands of your size realize that PAs are almost, they're so about like just throwing the vocals
exactly,
up there.
Exactly.
So much of the time, the cabinets, you know, the bass and guitar.
When I know decks. Ahead of time, depending on what kind of tour, our touring is never the same thing from one bout to the next. And we usually try to travel with something minimal like that, like a small power PH. So if we show up in a situation, we can just do the vocal.
I was going to ask if you had the cover your ass policy.
Oh, yeah, exactly. We've done without it before and regretted it. So we try to make room for it in the minivan.
And that's it really, what they put up there would fit the description of what an average band might have to rehearse with whatever.
It's like a rehearsal PA.
Yeah, it was not extraordinary.
No.
But they got the job done.
Totally. And I mean, as a live sound engineer, like you said, I mean, that's usually what I find. I might mic a band up, but if the club is small, I mean, I'm making sure people can hear the vocal, because anybody listening there who doesn't know anything about live audio, they just want to hear the singer, hear him singing, and the rest of it kind of falls into place behind that. If you're missing that link, everybody knows it's screwed up. But if you have the vocal, the majority of people are just going to, if the band's playing all right and you can hear the vocal, they're going to be satisfied. And I might think it sounds really screwed up.
And if possible, I say add a little ass to it. If there's a little thump,
if they can sing
along and shake their butt a little, then you've succeeded in the bigger picture. Yeah. Then you could tweak the details.
And luckily,
as much as you want.
Our drummer Justin has all the thump I can handle, so he brought that.
Great.
So that situation was an interesting gig, because we showed up. My expectation, I hadn't even really put any thought to it, because I just assumed it would happen. And, you know, what happens when you assume.
Now, for you guys, things have to go right more often than they go wrong. You've just done it too long. You wouldn't be here if things went wrong more often. But there also have to have been surprises that show I happened to be at. But there's got to be other shows
where they went
wrong or right in really interesting ways. Is there, you know, just a story or two you could share that would grab the imaginations of the people that are out there?
Well, for instance, I mentioned that show, The People in Las Cruces, New Mexico. It's a great group of people. Ended up a guy that went to my high school who was a fan of the band. He went to the high school a couple years after I did, but he got in the military, and now he lives in New Mexico. He was a fan of the band, turned all the jar-headed guys, whatever, the Marines, onto this. And it's a really strange gig for us, because none of us are military people. But when we go down to Las Cruces, we showed up, and it's kind of like I just threw this guy on his word. The first time we played there, I didn't really know. It's just a fan. He said he'd set up a show and his friends would come. And I was like, okay. And I just went with it. And I thought it would be a show in between some other good shows. It would just be something to bide time. And it ended up blowing the other shows away. But we had no idea till it actually happened that it was going to be that good. So we show up, and it's sort of like a dinner club where they have a stage and there's a bar and it's sort of a restaurant. And he's got this guy to agree to do a show. And I show up. There's just this one guy who booked the show for us and his girlfriend. And it's a restaurant. And I'm thinking, oh, well, I know where this show is going to go. It's not going to be any good. But again, right on time, and we showed up. We're like, we always try to keep and maybe that's just my influence. The guys in my band give up pretty easily, and I keep a good attitude. I'm like, I'm going to go through. If I agreed to be here, I'm not going to pack up and go home. I'm going to do it and make the best of it. And this was one of those situations. So we set up our gear.
And so this will at least be the second story in a row where this paid off for you to stick it through.
Exactly. So we set up the gear. Set up, you know, there was a little minimal PA set up there, which was really not adequate. But sure enough, right before we're going to play, here come like 40 of his crazy military buddies pouring with it. And they all know the music because here's another interesting thing. Not many of them had bought CDs. He had burned CDs for all his friends, and they had been sharing it, not really bought it. Because, you know, I keep track of sales. I know in Las Cruces, New Mexico, if I sell a CD to somebody or whatever, and it's not in a lot of stores down there, these guys all had burned copies of the CD, but they loved it. And we played the show. They all showed up. They got drunk as hell. They were all singing the words on stage with us. We played for like, you know, we played every song we knew. And we sold about $300 in merchandise to all those guys. And they got the club to give us like $200. And then one of the guys, we stayed the night at his house, and he just gave us $100 the next day for like a t-shirt. He's like, I want to take care of you guys. So we made like $600. Which was pretty good for us, for a show being like, we didn't know what was going to happen. And it was just kind of sticking to it. And I mean, it was luck too, but
I'm going to ask you about ethos. Is it, some people, I don't know if this is a real dichotomy or not, but some people have suggested that some bands play for themselves on stage, or some bands play for the audience on stage. how do you react to that? I presume in the shows where you think it's all going wrong, that it forces you to invoke a sense of playing for yourselves and and hoping to get that translation, that enthusiasm to translate.
Yeah, I've developed somewhat of an ability to be able to tune into myself and just make it happen regardless. For instance, showing up somewhere, you know, now we're actually playing a lot of these bigger venues. Being a sound guy, I get so sick of the guy, you know, the band. Not sick, I mean, I want to help them. Bands play, and they're like, between every song, they're telling me they want something different in the vocal, and they're complaining, and it does. And so I see that a lot, of a band that's up there talking to the sound guy through the whole set, saying what they want to change and all this stuff. And to me, it really brings, it always seems like it brings the performance down, and it really breaks down that image of just like it's a band and it's magic and it happens. So when I'm on stage, I might make one, if the monitors are really bad, I might make a comment like, hey, can I have more of this? And usually it's more vocal. And if it doesn't happen, I just try to ignore it and use my own instinct to play through whatever situation it is. So we've played some bigger shows recently where the monitors could be very important because I can't hear anything else if it's a big stage like at the LC or something. And that particular show for the radio, the monitors weren't really doing anything for me, but I really just tried to tune into myself and perform as I would if it sounded perfect.
Is there a way that you guys rehearse as a band, whether it's even how you face amps to each other? There's a lot of tricks that can be so-called tricks involved in this, to where you're better able to interact with each other and self-balance, because certainly I'm thinking the last time I saw you play, which was the Ohio Roller Girls, you guys seemed to lock into each other rather quickly, and there was no sound guy to complain to, so there were no complaints.
So yeah, I think that was probably a big part of it, not having any option. And we might do some of our best work where we don't have options, because then it's like the Beatles with four tracks, you make that work. And you don't have a lot of options to worry about.
It's also true for me, as somebody who almost exclusively lives on the technical side of the mixing board nowadays, that the bands that sound the best are also the easiest to mix. And they're usually the easiest to get along with, because they can articulate what they want and they self-balance themselves better. And between those two, then you get them there more quickly.
Yeah.
But I wonder what aspect of it has to do with ways that you rehearse or set yourselves up or communicate as a band to let you lock in so that you don't have the constant fight that you're talking about.
Some of it, I would say, is just our discipline and experience of like doing it. You know, it's for instance, like mic technique. When I'm a live sound guy and I see bands and the person's mm-hmm. you can never hear them, or they sing and they back up when they're screaming, and they kind of self-mix themselves on the mic. So there's a lot of that going on with our band playing to the situation, because we've played in living rooms before too, and we don't go balls out as loud as we can. We try to really tailor it for the situation, because we know, regardless of how we feel, it isn't the experience for the listener there. We're gonna have to play to the room to make it happen for them. So when we practice, you know, that's kind of rare actually. That's another issue. We do all sit in a pretty tight environment and we're all kind of listening to each other. So pretty much.
And you already told me that when you practice, you guys practice it at a much lower volume. And so for you guys, I guess you have a baseline standard that's much more modest, and then you only scale up the volume of the venue.
That could be a lot of it. So we're not lost if we have to be quieter, or if the drummer can't hear the vocal, we're not lost because he knows what he's doing. Like our practice experience is pretty wanting, because we don't have a practice space currently. And for a lot of this year, just for whatever reasons, that's the situation we've been in. So a lot of times we might just practice in the living room, which means minimal drum kit or no drum kit, and with just like a small practice amp, and I'm singing with no PA, and we're basically working on song structure, knowing where all the hits and starts and stops and everything is. So we deal with it at that level, so then we don't need a whole lot to be comfortable when we're live.
Do you... You posted in the room something about merchandising, and that elicited a lot of talk about Fugazi. Are there other very independently spirited bands that you could say you're trying to model your approach loosely?
Right. Well, Fugazi, you know, obviously to me, that's like a benchmark from me coming of age. They're the kind of the benchmark of indie success or something. But we pretty much come from the school of Midwestern DIY, you know, like Merge Records or, you know, even Sub Pop bands, and that put out their own records, book their own tours, and generate success out of their own gumption and their own do-it-yourself kind of drive. And so that's definitely what we're modeled after, like running our own record label and doing all the own, our own booking. I mean, I would love to have somebody else do the booking for me, and I would love to have somebody else put out the record. But and maybe it's just part of being maybe a little bit of a control freak, having done it so much myself. But I've never found anybody that cares enough to do it as good as I do it.
Are you finding with the I apparently internet-based changeover of the whole paradigm for the music industry, are you presuming that that's going to afford you, A, more opportunity to self-promote yourself and give you a different approach to it, and B, perhaps even minimize your need to produce physical CDs and physical materials and therefore have a lower cash output just to even begin that process?
I would say yes, although it's hard for me to digest that this early in the game because I'm so used to making that physical product. This year, I saw, you know, our sales, we made, there was a point during the year where I had made just as much off of like digital sales through iTunes and CD Baby digital distribution as I'd had through physical sales. And that was kind of like a watershed moment for me where I realized, you know, there might come a time where we don't really rely on the physical CD that we're making. And definitely that I try to stay on top of all of that, but it's hard. It's still a little early in the game for us specifically for me to digest what that's going to mean to us. But I really tried to stay on top of it and take advantage of anything that comes to the surface through where I don't have to put out money to do something. Cause I enjoy that, obviously. It's a good idea. It makes good business sense.
And I'm asking this for the sake of all people with bands out there, because we touched on this a little bit earlier on, but now I this conversation wants to make me loop back to merchandising.
Okay.
Everything from t-shirts, stickers, buttons. And again, if you don't mind me being too personal, looking in your wallet, what kinds of things are you able to either produce yourselves, sell? What do you sell the most of, and how does that financially relate in comparison to CD sales or show income or stuff? Is it for some bands, they might even make more at the merchandising table.
You know, like to bring back the Fugazi example, like they wouldn't even make t-shirts because somehow that was anti to their whole theme, you know, of making the band an
item. They're not a brand,
right? But I'm over that. My band can be a brand. I don't mind. I pretty much make stickers and buttons just as like giveaway stuff. I don't really rely on selling that at all. And I make t-shirts because, I mean, as a fan of music too, I like to have some sort of souvenir or something from a band to promote that I like it. And we sell not a large amount, but this year we've sold more t-shirts, and I haven't ever contracted with someone to make them on a large scale. I make them all myself, so I keep them down. I have been buying t-shirts in bulk from the drugstore. I get t-shirts for $2, and then I do an iron-on, had somebody make a design, and I print it out on my computer. And it takes me the physical time, but still, I make the shirts for like $4, $3 or $4, so I can sell them anywhere, depending on the gig, how much I can get. I sell them from $8, $10, or $12, which any of those is still really a lot cheaper than people normally sell t-shirts. So if I show up and I'm selling t-shirts for $10, I'm more than doubling what I spent on them. And
I want to say in the so-called big gigs that I work at, which is where I work most of the time, I want to say they're $25. Is the average.
Maybe. And ours are certainly a little more DIY quality, a little thriftier, but I mean, it's still enjoyable, and it relates to the experience of what the band's about.
I thought of you. I was looking through, I get like 11 billion catalogs. Uh-huh. You know, like I get every music magazine, every catalog. I'm on every list. Somehow it's worked out that way. And one of the CD DVD manufacturing places also had a t-shirt service listed back there. And
I've been looking at that, but I've never done it yet.
It's one of the big ones. We're probably looking at the same one.
Sure.
I'm only not saying their name because I don't know good or bad about them. So other than I've got their catalog.
But that's probably like to get it to do that run of t-shirts would be like $200 and something.
I thought it was $5.99 a shirt, $6 a shirt. And I was like, boy, that doesn't sound bad.
No, it's great. But to have the money to start out, that's where we come from. We make money, but we also always start out really on a budget. And I've kind of actually recently been getting into the idea. I have a lot of friends. A phenomenon that's kind of growing in popularity is like crafting, independent craft. As far as, I don't know if anybody out there has ever heard of Etsy, the website. It's a crafting website. People make clothes or any other kind of crafting items. And it's like a one-of-a-kind website. It's very popular. It's like the eBay of crafting.
You're not breaking out the fucking bedazzler now, are you?
No. But I'm saying I'm actually getting ready to open up a page or a shop on Etsy where I have like more one-off CDs. You know, I might make a CD that's a burn CD, a collection of tracks or something, new stuff we're working on or whatever, something that I'm not going to make a run of 1,000 of, but have more individual items that are offered on a page, maybe t-shirts that I make a few of or CDs that are limited run and more special that I can offer for sale through this page. Yeah, so it's another type of
but it's
merchandise.
An extremely personal contact with a band.
Right, exactly. So, which, you know, I don't really know how that's going to go yet, but it's something I had some fans suggest to me that they would like to have access to more. You know, I can't afford, we have, our band is kind of well-known, but not really on a large scale. So we have a lot of, well, we have a handful of incredibly enthusiastic fans who can't get enough. They have everything. We did the DVD, mm-hmm. t-shirts, whatever, CDs, and they want more. And but we're not popular enough where we make enough money that I can have a ton of stuff, 1,000 copies each.
You know what? This is making me think of when digital, before the real iTunes part of the digital distribution, but just when it was the just the plain old Wild West with
right.
the computers. I want to say it was the Residents. They did something where they sent blank CDRs, except with the printed album stuff and a jewel case with all the artwork, but it was completely blank. And when you ordered it, you were given the blank CDR, and that at a certain point in time, then you were given some, like a website or an
right.
unlock key, and then you could burn the CD of their tracks. That way you actually, even though you really were only buying a digital download, like you got
it
all
feels,
the artwork. It's very odd.
Ingenuitive, and it's a really interesting thing. And there you go. You're a good example of that's something you were a fan of, and that stuck in your brain so much that you remember it, and it's still kind of an exciting experience to connect you with that band. So that's how the Etsy thing I'm trying to work out is where I can have a more people that want a more personalized, which I'm not actually 100% being like I need to be available 100% of every day blogging or answering emails to people personally, but I think some people are wanting more of a connection, so I want to find a way to offer a little more things that are more limited edition, but still be able to do it and not have it cost me a bunch, but have, you know, that be available to people for merchandise. So we'll see how that goes. That's something I'm getting ready to do that I I'm not on the other side of it, so I can't tell you if it's been a success or not.
I understand that both of us have downloaded Radiohead's most recent release, if only because I wanted to participate in
exactly.
what I thought was an interesting experiment.
I am definitely a fan of Radiohead, and when I heard, you know, as everybody did recently, that they released the album internet only or whatever
it was
going to be.
I should explain this if you are unfamiliar okay. with Radiohead. They released it such that you could get a digital only version of the album, but it did not come with an attached particular price. You were able to actually input how much do you want to pay for this album, and whatever you input is what you paid
for
that album.
You could get it for free, or you could pay $12
yeah.
for the download. And I thought that was a really exciting idea, just so interesting. And I mean, I wanted the album anyway, but even more so just to be a part of that process, I logged on and I think I paid like $5 or $6 because I figured what the hell, I can afford that. And I knew I would probably I'll probably buy a physical copy of the album later just because I'm more of a completist.
I paid 10 or 12 because I said, this is what the, here's my.
You can give us your rationale.
Yeah. I said, that's what on iTunes, that's what so many of the completed albums cost. And so I'm going to say that's what fair market value is. And I want to give them fair market
right.
value for a normal download.
Which my thought process was, this is, I'm going to buy it again later. So I'm going to pay this a smaller amount just for the advanced listen. And to have it now so I can use it, and then I'll buy another copy later. Which I, you know, chances are that I probably have an 80, I might not, but I more than likely I know that I will. So I felt good about just giving them like a minimal amount because I realized for me when I sell stuff through iTunes, it's just sometimes it's like free money. I mean, I have a lot of backup a lot invested to it. So it's not for free, but I mean, I didn't have to do anything. They just click a button.
Oh, just to not have to deal with the duplication.
Exactly,
and distribution.
Just, so it's kind of exciting. And I was happy I got the download. And there weren't too many headaches in the process of downloading it.
Their idea seems to me like a very interesting one-shot idea. That's not the sustainable approach for the future. Right. There's no way. Your ideas about a more personal relationship with the fan and having that. Now, that is more sustainable if you have the time to develop that kind of marketing approach.
I definitely was paying attention when they did that. And for our next release, I'm developing ideas right now where we'll have a digital release where you can buy it a la like the Radiohead release. Mm-hmm. But I'm also going to be developing this winter. We have a bunch of video footage and we have some music videos and we're going to make another one. So I'm going to put a DVD of a couple of music videos that aren't available anywhere else and possibly like a small 30-minute documentary on the making of the album. That'll be packaged with a physical CD release so you can buy the album online for a certain price or download it from iTunes, A Song at a Time, if you must. Or you have the option and or to buy the physical release that I'm going to put out in whatever quantity I do that would have an additional incentive because it'll have the DVD along with the album.
And I presume you'll do the same thing. Radiohead did provide the two options in their case,
right,
where if you bought the physical stuff, you automatically got all the
downloads
too.
Right.
So you had them right away and you had them, you know, for your iPod or your phone or whatever you're going to do with them. God forbid a Zune or something like that.
Right. And it's kind of hard to draw comparisons because, I mean, a band like Radiohead being so well known and having come out of the major label machine, they have the name recognition to be able to do something and pull it off with great success like that. But it just makes the ideas that behind it more available to indie bands like us to take it, change it, and maybe do something that can be beneficial, that's what our plans are for the future, for the next record.
There's been a lot of hype, whether deserved or not, for sites like MySpace. Are you able to measure any difference in sales or popularity or building up attendance at shows in areas that you're not at by having the MySpace page and networking through there?
There's so much stuff that happens on MySpace that doesn't amount to anything. I mean, I think it's great and I'm going to stay. It's so little effort and money on my part that I'd be a fool not to participate. But the main thing that I've noticed for us is locally. We had all that success on the radio locally, and I got tons of requests. I keep everything in a folder. People, our friends who join us, I go look at them. We get tons of band requests, which I generally don't accept unless I feel, because, you know, we get like a rap producer from Hollywood, California. Like, I realize that's just some computer generated guy trying to, or whoever, they have a bot that's going around accepting or making friends. But anyway, back to the point.
It just has to have some sort of
exactly.
Obvious,
so I go look any when people want to be our friend, I go and I look at their profile, and then I generally accept them, and I keep them in some folders that are by state, and so I have a huge list of people from Columbus or Ohio, and a majority of those are fans that found out about us from this radio success we have, and that has been very useful to me, because when we have shows, I send specifically targeted to those people in Columbus that we're having a local show, and that's really made a difference with our local audience and pretty much like our people requesting from the radio, buying it locally in stores, just our profile rising locally. Other than that, it hasn't translated.
Even though I'm a bit of a geek, I don't off the top of my head know which tools you would use to separate your MySpace people by region. Are you using any specialized software or things that are helping you to do? Okay.
I do it by hand. I keep them all in folders, and then I'm not up so much on the MySpace specific tools either to do that. I've just pretty much, I can't describe.
Do people sign up for lists at shows too? Do you probably do that?
Yeah, and I keep those. I also keep email lists from when we tour. I have like a wider ranging tour email list, but then I also have it broken down into regions of like, well, I break it down and there's a local list of people. There's the broader touring list. I have magazines. And
so if you're playing a show in New Jersey, you're not telling the people in Georgia?
Generally not. Generally, we send out an email that tells everybody all the shows, but then if they're in the area. Yeah, I don't, if you don't get the email. But if you're in New Jersey, you might get two emails, one about the whole tour and then one specifically about the show there.
So it'll seem a lot less spammy because you're paying attention.
Right, right. So I try to really, I try not to send out too much spam. I keep everything to a minimum because I get so much spam myself, as I'm sure you
do. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and also it doesn't have a lot of impact. The more it's hard on our end to be personalized because it takes a lot of work, but also you realize that you get so much like stuff that it doesn't get through anybody's, you know, perception hardly, if it's because they don't pay attention.
And so I think we should start wrapping up by discussing a little bit more about what we should expect to see from Earwig in 2008, since we're almost there.
All right. This year we had a batch of songs that we toured on, and we finished up the touring, which was kind of like the tour. We released an album this year, Center of the Earth, which has the song Used Kids that got all the radio play locally, and that's also available in Meyer stores and online through Lizard.
Although I almost have to hate you for the fact that I walk around going, there's this lyric, you know, I don't want to sleep with your sister. You know, anyway, there's lyrics from that album. But my wife has a sister that's my age, and I can't, these lyrics stuck in your head. I'm like, I don't want to sleep with your sister. I just want to kiss her. Like, that's going to get me.
The lyric got me into trouble. As you know, my wife has a pretty exciting sister herself. So, you'll have to buy the album.
I don't know how you get that one past.
There's a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah.
So, we toured on our album Center of the Earth. And we also toured the batch of new songs, which as soon as we were done with the tour in October, we went into the studio here locally and did a session with what will become our next record. We're going to finish recording it out ourselves, or who knows what, probably ourselves, with some combination of online preceding a full physical release with a DVD. And that'll come out in the spring or early summer. And I'm lining up, I just talked to a guy this morning, there's kind of like an X Games type of tour that is being set up by a company called Team Sports Marketing. It's called the A Games, the Adrenaline Games, where they have skateboarding, BMX, and we're going to hopefully be attached to a larger tour in summer 2008 that's going to take us around all in the Midwest with the kind of extreme sports touring thing. And that'll be our first bout of touring, and that's about as far as I have planned.
I could think of 100 more questions to ask, and we at best have gone through a cursory outline style version of these,
right,
the kind of top worthy of further discussion. So in order to make it not seem so final, I need to offer up your profile on the website is...
Okay, so you're talking about MySpace?
At the womb.
Oh, Earwig.
So you will see a user named Earwig, and
That's
we're going to do is we're going to set up an area where we can... More directly focus any questions for all the areas that I haven't explored in this 5-minute chunk of discussion. Because if you've made it this long, we thank you.
Yes, thank you. As I mentioned earlier, it's hard for me to tell, just us sitting here talking, I don't know what's useful to people or what they really want to know. So I kind of feel like a geek just talking about myself. But if anyone heard anything that piqued their interest about a specific something we touched on and wanted to know more, if they post about it, I'd be happy to come back and talk more about it or post about it online and answer questions, because I don't mind talking about it. I don't know what people are interested in.
Yeah, and this is what got me to be a moderator in a forum. I am endlessly fascinated in how do bands market themselves? How do you really make a tour work? What are the things you're doing successfully to get yourself promoted and, you know, form the relationship. I mean, there's these topics that I think are very worthy of discussion. If there's a lot of questions, we'll just keep answering them and discussing this online. So this is not the end of the interview, but this is the beginning. Hopefully,
you are very moderate.
I do what I can.
Yeah. So it's a good position for you to be the moderator.
I do what I can. With that, we're closing out. We're listening to more of Earwig as recorded by Kenny Joya in Wrong Island. And we look for you now. Please join us in the forums. Let's ask Earwig some more questions. And let's discuss these top. Cue Earwig for being
solid.